Good evening. On behalf of the Council on Foreign Relations and the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, U.S.-Cuban Relations in the 21st Century. I know it's going to be very interesting because tonight we have with us Dr. Julia Zweig, Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin American Studies and Director for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. I am Mathea Falco, President of Drug Strategies, and I will be your moderator this evening. A quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis for informed action. To learn more about the organization, visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. When you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming audio and video online. Council programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World, which airs every Monday night at 8 p.m. on NPR KQED 88.5 FM. Tonight's program is being recorded for future broadcast, and I would like to thank our audio engineer, Paul Lancour. Now, before we begin, I have been instructed to remind you to take a moment to turn off all cell phones and other noise-making devices. So now I see everybody's doing that. That's good. While you do that, I would like to take this opportunity to announce the upcoming annual conference, World Affairs 2010, on March 11th and 12th, just a few blocks away at the Westin St. Francis here in San Francisco. This year's conference will be focusing on innovative leadership in the face of crisis. Please mark your calendars and visit itsyourworld.org to register for this exciting event. That's actually only about 2 weeks away. Lastly, I would encourage you all to make use of the blue question cards that have been placed on your seats. Please hand them over to the Council staff members who will be coming through to pick them up. I'm counting on them because I'm going to draw on those blue cards to ask Julia during the second half of our program probing questions about her thoughts on Cuba. It's now my honor to introduce our guest this evening. Dr. Julia Zweig is one of the country's leading experts on Cuba and Latin America. She is the author of numerous publications, and she has directed several Council on Foreign Relations reports on Latin America. Her book, which you can see over on the table, called Inside the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro and the Urban Underground, received the American Historical Association's Herbert, that's not the book that's on the table.
I love that you're plugging the other one.
We're being recorded, so just ignore that little statement. But in any event, that's also a great book. By the way, if you haven't figured it out, I'm one of Julia's greatest fans, which is why I'm doing the moderation tonight. But now here's the real point about the book on the table, and that is that she's published Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know, which I have actually thoroughly read. It's sort of a wonderful upscale dummy's guide to Cuba, and it's set up in a very, very friendly, user-accessible question and answer format, which means that you can just ingest it very rapidly. Dr. Zweig serves on international boards and frequently provides commentary for major television, radio, and print media. She holds advanced degrees from Johns Hopkins University, and she has her BA from the University of California at Berkeley. So she's one of us. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Julia Zweig. Now, Julia's going to make some opening remarks, basically to stimulate active discussion for about 10 minutes, and then we'll start the ball bouncing all around. So, Julia.
Well, Mathea, first of all, let me thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining me here tonight. It's a thrill and an honor to be with you and to be here in San Francisco, where I also went to high school. So I feel like I'm back at home, and very, very happy that all of you are able to come tonight. And thanks to the World Affairs Council for hosting me again. Mathea and I were talking in the room adjacent to this room just now, and I realized in talking to her that tomorrow, February 24th, marks the two-year anniversary of Raul Castro formally taking power as president of Cuba. So the timing of this event gives us an opportunity to reflect a little bit on what has happened in those last 2 years. I will do that in a moment, but I also want to just highlight a couple of events that have happened much more recently that relate to Cuba and more broadly the region. Some of you might have noticed that over the weekend in Cancun, 32 foreign ministers and 25 heads of state of Latin America got together to begin the process of inaugurating a new regional Latin American organization led by or on the basis of the initial Rio Group membership. This new organization will exclude the United States and Canada. Raul Castro was present for that meeting, as he was a year ago for another iteration of it. Tomorrow, President Lula of Brazil will visit Cuba as part of his victory lap multi-nation touring that he's going to take this year during his last year in office. And he will also go to Haiti. And also just last week, some quite senior administration officials from the Obama administration were in Havana for bilateral talks on immigration. So it's a busy time in this neck of the woods, and Cuba manages to be, even without its charismatic leader Fidel Castro at the helm, very, very present in a number of regional and global and bilateral fora. So that's just a little bit of news noting. 2 years ago, Raul Castro took office, and one of the most notable things about his inaugural address was that it was 34 minutes long. And, of course, that elicits a laugh because his brother's addresses, not quite 34 hours, but certainly 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 hours. So the style of his delivery, the brevity of his statement was refreshing to the Cuban population, as was the substance of what he laid out that had the effect of raising expectations domestically. So I will talk a bit just about what it was that he laid out in those 34 minutes and what has and has not happened subsequently and why and where I think we are right now, where Cuba is, where Cuba is going. This is a lot to cover in 10 minutes. And then if you, Mathea, will ask me anything I don't cover, as I hope you will. The inaugural address came after about an 18-month period of Raul having provisional power during Fidel Castro's intestinal illness. And in that period, the regime carried out a sort of national pulse-taking, encouraging the Cuban people in a variety of different ways to air their frustrations with a number of different, many different problems on the island. And so by the time he got to give his speech, he had a pretty clear idea of what the most important demands of the population were and what the level of tolerance within the nomenclatura, the party, the military, the key focal points of power, tolerance for reforms. The agenda he laid out was an agenda for modest and moderately paced reforms. He didn't ever use that word, but he talked about instituting an agrarian reform, which has started, shrinking the size of the bureaucracy, which has begun, taking steps, to quote him, to improve the material and spiritual lives of the Cuban people, an important formulation. And he talked about other steps aimed at, without saying so, hinting at privatization, introducing more market forms in the economy, generally trying to get the state out of the way so that Cubans could have more opportunity to produce for themselves. He sounded more like Margaret Thatcher than Karl Marx in terms of talking about productivity and efficiency and the unfairness of an egalitarian system in which people can be paid by the state and get all kinds of freebies by the state and not work, whereas hardworking people can work hard and not necessarily benefit. So he began a debate inside of Cuba about the role of the state, the possible role of the market, about the nature of property, private and otherwise, that has continued and, in fact, deepened in the last 2 years. But what has not happened, and a couple of other things, he announced that Cubans would be able to buy cell phones and would be able to use their resources to go to the hotels previously only allowed to foreign tourists. Those were two things that Cubans talked about, complained intensely about being prohibited from doing, as well talked about eliminating the requirement that Cubans have to ask permission from the government in order to travel abroad. Another deeply resented abridgment of basic rights of citizenship that in this kind of pulse-taking process Cubans complained about. Another dynamic that raised expectations inside of Cuba was our own presidential campaign in 2007 and 2008, in which, especially as Barack Obama began to gather steam as a candidate, he talked about taking steps to begin to open up to the Cuban people. And so the combination of the Obama candidacy and then presidency and then the opening of possibility of change by Raul had raised expectations. But in the middle of 2008, a series of events took place that have had the effect of quashing some of the momentum that I think was expected in the beginning of Castro's presidency, Raul's presidency. And that was, first of all, the food and fuel crisis began to raise costs significantly for Cuba. Second, the country was hit by three hurricanes in September of 2008 that took out 20% of the GDP in one fell swoop. And third, the global financial crisis, the effects of which linger today. So Cuba today has moved a lot more slowly in implementing some of these modest reforms that he talked about. And likewise, the United States government, the Obama administration, has moved more slowly in taking steps towards opening to the island than I think the regime was expecting. And that those two dynamics reinforce one another. I can talk a little bit about how and in what way. And where we are today in Cuba is a very slow process. I think it's gone from sort of one that was pretty much frozen in ice to a little slushy. So if you just go online and read the state papers, Juventud Rebelde Granma, you see there the most open discussion and range of criticism of everything that's wrong with the state, with the bureaucracy, and everything that needs to change that I've seen in my memory of following this. And yet there is no consensus internally among the leadership about where they're taking the country and how to do it. We still haven't seen a unification of the currency, which feeds inequality and the perception of inequality. Lots of steps that could be taken haven't been, and Cuba continues to sort of wait for the United States to move on some key points in order to move. Last point, it isn't that an elimination of the embargo by the United States would create democracy and a market economy tomorrow in Cuba. I think it's very important to disaggregate those two. But what more forward movement from the United States would accomplish is loosening up the state of siege mentality that still grips the national security complex in Cuba, if you will, and creating more space for those advocating for a more accelerated pace of economic reform. And I'll stop there.
Well, that was a very interesting opening, Julia, and I love the image of having moved from frozen to slushy. And following up on the slushy point, one of our audience members has a related question about the lifting, the Obama administration lifting some of the heavier restrictions on travel to Cuba, but really only for Cubans. And his question is, how far are we from allowing scholars and students once again to travel to Cuba for research? And that is, I remember, because we've both benefited from right. that exception in the past to go to Cuba. And how do you see that changing, if at all, in the near term, like the next year before the next slush?
So I'll answer in a second, but just for background, in April of 2009, the Obama administration announced the elimination of restrictions for Cuban Americans to travel to Cuba and for Cuban Americans to send remittances to their family members. And since then, 300,000 to 400,000 Cuban Americans have visited. But of course, there are 1.8 million Cuban Americans, and the change in policy doesn't affect those of us without family in Cuba. The scholarly and educational and cultural exchanges that Mathea and the questioner referred to began in the 1990s. Well, there were previous iterations of that, but the most recent example was that even with Congress having to lift the travel ban to do it whole cloth, this administration has the executive authority under current law to substantially liberalize the ability for the rest of us to go under licenses. And the momentum toward doing that was thwarted in 2009 by the coup in Honduras and its aftermath, and I can explain what I mean by that, but it sort of put a big pause on U.S. policy toward Latin America overall and had the effect, I think, of intimidating the bureaucracy and the administration from going any farther. Now we do have our assistant secretary confirmed and in office, Arturo Valenzuela, and he is signaling that he will begin to try to entertain this liberalization. But, honestly, right now it is still such a heavy lift for a university or a museum or a synagogue or any institution to get a license for their members to go there. And given everything else on the plate of this administration, I still am cautious and, or let's say, skeptical that within the next year we'll have the much more open exchange that we had up until 2001.
So there won't be a World Affairs Council trip to Cuba anytime soon from San Francisco.
Well, I don't know. The World Affairs Council of San Francisco is so powerful, you might be able
That's right.
to.
That's a very good point. looking to the future, what about leadership in Havana after Raul? And the question from the audience is he developing a new leadership group? And if so, are there any individuals that stand out?
Oh, this is such a hard question.
But this is something you're a specialist in.
No, but I know when to say that I don't know. And one of the other things that happened in Cuba in 2009 was that Raul Castro purged four or five of the key people whom many inside and outside saw as the potential successors. And though, in addition to those direct purges, others retired or were moved aside. So the truth is now what you're seeing is not a, in terms of the top leadership, not really a generational succession. In fact, Raul has brought people back in who were retired, but that come from the founding generation. And the younger folks are there. They're working in the parties. They're working in the military. But I can't say to you, here are the four or five superstars that are next in line, because those guys were
purged. Even though I do remember, we used to have wonderful conversations about that before the purge, because
right.
there were that whole group of relatively younger people.
That's right.
Pérez Roque and
Pérez Roque, who was the foreign minister. Sorry, I just completely froze on the name. Carlos
Laje. Right.
Sorry. Who was the sort of Minister Without Portfolio, and a few other, Fernando Ramirez, mm-hmm. Individuals in their 40s and 50s who were part of Fidel's team. And so we can get in the purge. The decision to move them aside was based on questions of loyalty to their elders, not to the revolution, but to their elders, and also about Raul Castro consolidating his power.
So interesting.
And signaling to the outside world, too, that even if some in Latin America, the United States, elsewhere, saw these guys as the potential successors and maybe therefore reformers, which aren't necessarily equivalent, the move to eliminate them was a sign to say, you know, don't equate succession with reform.
Well, we have a very mysterious and anonymous question from the audience, which I cannot resist asking, and I'll read it directly. Julia, have you received a response from the Obama administration regarding your well-known letter? Now, if you don't know what this is about, we can move on to oil drilling offshore.
I'm sorry, is my microphone working still?
I'm sure somebody here might be able to tell.
Well, not a personal response. No, I have not received a personal response. I believe the letter to which the question refers is my memo to the president that I published on the front cover of Cigar Aficionado the month that he came into office. And it's a very esteemed academic journal. I'm sure you've seen it.
But it is widely read.
Widely read. I think the answer is in what they are doing and what they're not doing. My letter was laid out a roadmap for approaching Cuba bilaterally in terms of diplomacy and cooperation and working with Congress, and it laid out how to think about issues of democracy and open society in Cuba. And I would say that the response has been to say thank you very much and implement a couple of the steps, but not more.
There are a number, I must say, these questions are fascinating. I think at some point we should probably publish them because they capture the full range of American debate about Cuba in the last at least 20 years. But let's start with this one. Julia, do you think there will be any resistance among the Cubans who don't approve of Raul Castro's moderate but progressive policies? Or in other words, what is the nature of the dissent movement now in Cuba?
Oh.
We could go to oil drilling offshore.
No. We'll get to oil, but it's an extremely important question. There's a kind of low-intensity repression that persists in Cuba that is both imposed by the state but also now a part of the political culture of censorship and self-censorship. And on the one hand, expression in Cuba, especially in the cultural spheres, has never been more free in the period of the last 50 years. But organized dissent by people that call themselves dissidents is not completely quashed, but it is barely tolerated. And so there is some space for official dissenters, and of course some of you follow the ups and downs of the blogosphere and some of the high-profile people within that. The state has been very effective at making sure that there is space for dissenters within existing institutions on the one hand, but making sure that those who choose to call themselves dissidents and receive support from the outside, especially from the United States, have as little space as possible in which to maneuver.
Well, this is a somewhat related question about the actual daily reality of life in Cuba. And I know you've had a number of opportunities to see it firsthand. The questioner, however, did visit Cuba under the Batista regime, and again a few years ago. So that is a wonderful span of history. And the questioner points out that this time there were no beggars on the street in Havana. School children seemed happy and well-fed. And yet, on the other hand, one hears a great deal that this is not such a paradise. And the questioner would like to know, what is the reality? Is it a worker's paradise, or is it a glorified prison? If you don't like
is
that, you know what your other
question.
Choice is.
I mean, the answer is that it is neither. You know, material conditions in Cuba have, put it this way, in Cuba, Cubans are very good at distributing what little they have very equally. And so by Latin American standards, there really still is very little inequality in Cuba. But by Latin American standards, there's very little productivity. The state has been able to, with its budget and with help from Venezuela and remittances and resources from mineral sales and other sources of revenue, tourism, keep sustaining levels of education and healthcare that remain quite impressive. But there's very little else to go around. And so the material you didn't see beggars, whoever you are, there because there's a social safety network there that still functions. But, you know, it is a difficult place to live, for sure. And it has become more difficult since the financial crisis. Cuba went through a period, let me just finish, of between about, like the rest of Latin America, between about 2003 and 2007 or 8, of even according to the CIA, 7, 8, 9% growth per year. Its sales abroad of bauxite were nickel, extremely lucrative. So it has suffered, and there's been an entrenchment. But, you know, workers' paradise, definitely not. What was the other one? Stalinist prison?
No. Glorified prison.
Glorified prison.
That's all right.
No.
I think
okay.
we have the,
thank
the
you.
Drift. Now, turning to the Canadian trade policy.
Okay.
During the last decade.
Keep burying the oil question.
I'm holding it.
Okay.
I'm holding it because I think the moment will come. Has the Canadian trade policy with Cuba helped the country to develop and become part of the modern world? I mean, in contrast, for example, to policies of other neighbors in Latin America and North America?
Well, yes. Canada has been helpful in that, right? But Canadian foreign investment, which is in telecommunication and minerals and tourism primarily, is sector specific. On the other hand, in a certain sense, it's limited. But on the other hand, Canadian business schools have brought Cubans to study in Cuba, as have the Spanish and other European countries. So I think that connection to with our neighbor to the north has absolutely been helpful to Cuba in making a transition to a post-Soviet era.
There are a number of questions, of course, about the future and what it might look like in terms of opening on our part and further opening and development in Cuba. And I think we've touched on a lot of that, but the theme recurs. And part of one of these questions is that if Cuba does open more and we ourselves open more, will Miami move back to reclaim property, and what will happen? Will chaos ensue?
Well, the chaos model of the future is one that the Cuban government promotes in order to make clear that the government remains the best protector of the revolution's achievement in the face of hostility from Miami. But I think that Miami with some exceptions, some very important exceptions, has actually moved to a different place with respect to property restitution or any notion that Cuban Americans are going to go back and either get back their small-scale property or their large-scale property. We're talking 50 years, and there is Castro fatigue, embargo fatigue, Cuba fatigue in Miami, just as there is outside of Miami. So I think the notion of, I can't imagine a moment in which the existing government in Cuba will be gone enough to open the door for the hostile anti-Castro traditional Miami class to go back in and take it over. No.
This is a somewhat related question, and it says, Julia, please answer this.
Are those of you that are using my name people that I know?
I hope so. And it's an interesting one. In my time spent in Cuba, Cubans felt that ending the embargo would reveal a failure of the Cuban state. Without the scapegoat of the embargo, the government would have to take responsibility for housing and poverty. Could you speak to this, is the question.
You know, I think that process has already happened. And what one of the refreshing things about Raul Castro is that he has made it kosher and politically correct to disaggregate the embargo from the internal failings of the government, much more so than under Fidel. And so now Cubans are talking about the changes that they need to make internally, regardless of what the United States does. Not to say that what the United States does isn't critically important, but again, I would definitely take a tour on the Cuban websites of their state-controlled media to see how much sort of frontal, much more honest discussion there are about the domestic shortcomings of the regime, totally separate from the embargo.
Do you have a preferred website you could suggest?
Well, no, granma.org.cu. I mean, I'm literally talking about Juventud Rebelde and Granma. Just go to those two places and you'll see it. But you see it and you hear it on the street. Now, the embargo, the lifting of the embargo will have many consequences and not all immediately positive for Cuba. So I think it's a very important question and scenario to think through.
Can you give us any details of Cuban offshore oil drilling? I was saving that one.
Thank you. I wish I had the map. The majors globally, the private oil companies and the state-run oil companies, almost all of them have bid on some pieces of Cuba's territorial waters. And there is exploration going on still to hit the big one. I can't give you that many details, unfortunately, but what I can tell you is that the Cuban government believes that it is sitting on 10 to 12 billion barrels of oil offshore. Consortiums made of European and Asian, including Chinese, still have not found where that is, but some of it, the Cuban government speculates, is very, very close to the maritime border in the Gulf of Mexico between U.S. waters and Cuban waters. So mm-hmm. that will become very interesting. And if you look at the map of where the there's a technical term for this, but which foreign oil company is where, what you see is it looks like the Cuban government is saving the spots closest to U.S. territorial water potentially for American oil companies as a kind of enticement, and the American oil companies have all seen these maps, as an enticement to inspire the companies to lobby the U.S. government to let them come in and explore.
Fascinating. Are we still selling significant amounts of agricultural products to Cuba?
Yes, indeed we are. In 2000, a legislation known as the Ashcroft Amendment, after John Ashcroft, then a senator, passed in the Congress, and it allowed American producers of food and other agricultural products to sell to Cuba. And since then, the numbers have gone up and up to as high as $800 million in American agricultural exports to Cuba for cash only. We have become, in a couple of these years, sometimes Cuba's number two and number three supplier of food. That has begun to decline, in part, I think, as a result of a political strategy, which was, let's buy from the Americans because we can sort of cherry-pick and buy from the districts of representatives who will then vote for legislation to further right. eliminate sanctions. And that kind of wore itself out and failed to deliver much more from the Congress. So to the extent that where the Cubans can get lower prices, they still buy from the United States, but they're starting to decide that maybe their strategy isn't going to yield so much, so they're buying from other partners as well.
So going back to last weekend and the gathering in Mexico that you mentioned, what effect does that have on Cuba's relationship with ALBA, an acronym that apparently includes Nicaragua, Bolivia, and Venezuela?
Yes. ALBA, you know, there's this kind of regional gerrymandering or redistricting that's happening in Latin America. And one of the groupings is ALBA, and it stands, I don't know what it stands for.
You're just saying that to make me feel better.
No, I actually forget. It's the Association of Latin American Bolivar. Anyway.
That's probably right. That's good. Bolivarian.
Venezuela,
right.
Bolivia, and it is Bolivarian. Nicaragua,
right.
Cuba, Ecuador, I think is not a full member yet, St. Kitts.
So the question is...
Yes, so what's the question? We just talk about Cuba's relationship to ALBA?
How do you see that affecting Cuba and Cuba's role in the mm-hmm. region going forward? I mean, is this significant, or
it
should
is.
We...
It actually is significant. You know, I think for some time I sort of poo-pooed ALBA myself, but there's a lot of shifts happening in Latin America with these new groupings. UNASUR, led by the Brazilians especially, is one. Now this new expanded Rio group, ALBA, and they're all among themselves figuring out how and over what issues to relate to one another. You know, the financing that has emanated from Venezuela to the members of the ALBA groupings is not insignificant and is completely lacking in transparency and has real political weight. And it isn't only the ALBA countries, too, that are beneficiaries of this largesse. And it is also the many of the Caribbean countries. And that translates into votes at the OAS. And it translates into the ability to block something the United States wants to do. Chavez's own tenure in Venezuela is, the opposition would argue, coming to, you know, he's on shakier ground, but he's going to be there for a while, and I think that this ALBA grouping is very important. Now, Cuba has quite strategically taken advantage of this in order to execute its succession with Chavez out there taking the slings and arrows and picking the fights with the Americans, takes advantage of the Venezuelan largesse quite effectively, and has importantly not only been the beneficiary of Venezuelan support, but has been very instrumental in helping Chavez consolidate power inside of Venezuela. So I think this moment of increasing independence within Latin America from the historic American hegemony and Cuba's ability to take advantage of it, not just in ALBA, but with its relations with Brazil, with Mexico, quite a diverse ideological portfolio, is one of the things that is helping Cuba weather this succession process.
That's such an interesting development within Latin America, and I wonder to what extent you think that U.S. government neglect or lack of attention to the region relative to its other major foreign policy concerns might contribute or encourage those kinds of other regional groupings.
Oh, it has without a doubt encouraged those other kinds.
I thought that might be a yes, but
that's a yes. I mean, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about foreign? I mean,
sure.
You our government's Latin American focus, if any.
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot lately about the meaning of Latin America or the coherence of Latin America as a construct and as an entity that the United States has or doesn't have the capacity to relate to as a whole. The Latin Americans are thinking about this too. I've been especially thinking about it lately. I've been visiting Brazil a great deal, and Brazilians do not think of themselves, mostly they say they don't think of themselves as Latin Americans, but rather as South Americans. Brazil, of course, is the anchor of South America and very important now in the Americas, but it sort of calls, Brazil's rise calls into question, of course, the coherence of a Latin America. And the United States, you know, to give credit or at least be a little bit sympathetic, I think it is no longer realistic to have one large Latin America policy. And so I think we're seeing the attempt now to deal with these new aggregations and come up with sensible bilateral policies. But having said all of that, Latin America isn't a priority. We do not have the budget or the bandwidth to have sort of a big, holistic, well-resourced Latin America policy, and I'm not sure that Latin Americans themselves any longer want that. So I see you know, this moment as one of significant realignment, and neither the Latin Americans nor the Americans in government, I think, have figured out exactly what they want from one another at this stage, beyond sort of the basics of a level playing field in trade, sensible immigration policies, a drug policy that is actually effective. I mean, I think there's agreement on those things, but in terms of this new world that we're entering, I think it's all being developed as we speak.
Well, let's talk a little bit about drug production and trafficking in Latin America.
Your expertise.
And, you know, even today in Washington, there have been these high-level meetings between our government, the Mexican government, et cetera,
yes,
about what we are going to do about the increasing violence and lawlessness associated with the trafficking, not only in Mexico, but increasing parts of Latin America. For many years, I have heard, and I know you have too, that the Cuban government was at least complicit in facilitating the drug traffic through the Caribbean, which remains a major trafficking route for cocaine coming up to this country. That was particularly talked about during the Bush administration, as I remember, that it was just another reason why we really did not want to have relations at all with these people. What's your take on this issue now? In particular, how do you think Raul Castro's government is addressing certainly rising trafficking through the region? Whether and do you think they have any involvement at all?
In 1989, Mateo's making reference to a moment in which the United States let the Castro government know, the United States government let the Castro government know that it was aware that some senior officials in the government were involved with the Colombian cartels. And what transpired inside of Cuba was a very public process that resulted in the execution of a couple of very senior intelligence and military officials, the Ochoa affair. And in its wake, the consolidation of the intelligence, the Interior Ministry, and the armed forces under Raul Castro's watch. The regime has since then been in practice, and as far as I can tell, quite serious about making sure that as it opens up to foreign tourism, it prevents as much as possible Cuba from becoming a trafficking point for transit because, of course, where Cuba is located, it could be a major hub.
Ideally situated.
Ideally situated. Right. And the truth is what we've seen as the Colombian cartels, first when the major cartels were busted up and then in the wake of Plan Colombia having some success, the drugs have gone up through Mexico and they've come up through Central America, but not generally through Cuba. And Cuba has repeatedly asked and has cooperation agreements with Canada, with the UK, with other countries in the region, asked for more so just recently last week with the United States. And my sense is that there's an understanding that that inside the regime that they cannot withstand allowing themselves to become vulnerable to organized crime and drug trafficking, given all of their other problems. So they're looking to keep it out.
Now we're going to turn to the subject of racism because we now have three questions that are related tangentially to that. Most specifically, Raul's pulse taking of the nation. Was racism an important concern? And if so, has he, Raul, and his group made any effort to address it? I remember just parenthetically that whole issue of race has been at the heart of Cuba since the 1898 revolution. And I think you told me years ago that nothing had really changed. But I know that was probably off the record, but why don't you tell us tonight what you think the situation is now?
I don't think I was that unequivocal about it.
I'm sure you weren't.
Okay. You know, race, maybe not 2 years ago when this pulse taking happened, but very, very recently in the last 6 months, in fact, race has been one of the issues that is on the table. And I'm not sure whether it has gotten more light recently because some prominent African-American artists and writers issued a statement calling on the regime to deal with racism internally, or because it is one of the many issues that is festering there. But the, you know, Afro-Cubans have benefited from the revolution, but they also do not have the kind of political representation that they ought to, given their numbers. And there's a kind of cultural dynamic that still persists that precedes the 1959 revolution, in which, you know, racism is sort of part and parcel of the parchment of Cuban society. So it is on the table now more so than previously.
Not directly related, but we do have a question about Raul's criminalization of the poor. That's a quote from the question. And I think that the explanation here is increased prison sentences for those who run small businesses, local barbers, shoemakers, etc., to supplement their low wages. I'm just commenting, presumably that means without authorization from the state. I mean, is this a question that address?
Let me try to address it. The Human Rights Watch report on Cuba that came out recently attempted to make the argument that the regime has started to politicize and punish politically people that are trying to make a living in the black market.
Right. I think that's the reference.
I think that is a distorted interpretation. The black market thrives in Cuba. As in most of Latin America, the informal sector is enormous. I am not aware, other than what I read in the Human Rights Report, the Human Rights Watch report, of any kind of systematic attempt to imprison people or treat politically people that are working in the black market. There is an effort, I think, to for the state to get the resources that are floating around in the black market and to, they haven't figured out how to legalize small businesses. But I don't know how the person framed it, but politically, what was the line?
Well, we can reframe it.
Okay. it doesn't resonate with what I know of what's happening there, at least not in a systematic way
at
all.
So do you think the Human Rights Watch report is accurate, is doing a disservice? I mean, how do you assess
it? I think the Human Rights Watch report, and I would say this to my friend Jose Miguel Vivanco if he were here and have said it, is that, you know, they sent somebody there for 2 weeks and interviewed a lot of people, but I don't think that that is a methodology that allows them to draw the conclusions that they've drawn.
Well, one of our...
At least on that front.
One of our related questions then is, why does the U.S. continue to label Cuba a terrorist nation?
Al Haig, may he rest in peace, was in office, I believe, when the United States first put Cuba on the terrorist list in 1983. And the reason for that at the time was because of Cuba's support for insurgency in Central America. The reasons have evolved in the last, how many years is that? Couple of decades. Most recently, and actually not most recently, but I think in March of this year, every March the State Department releases its report that says why X country is on the terrorist list. Already, the explanation has become a little bit flojo, you know, kind of weak. It is because Cuba has members of the Colombian FARC living there and also of the Spanish terrorist group ETA. But those two groupings of people are there at the request of the Colombian government and of the Spanish government. I think the presence on the terrorist list is completely about domestic politics. And Jerry Bremer, who was, of course, in Iraq in the 1990s, was asked by the Clinton administration to take a look at the terrorist list and concluded that Cuba should come off of the list.
Was this before or after he was in Iraq?
This was before he was in Iraq. This was before he was in Iraq. In any case, it is a legacy of the Cold War period that Cuba remains on the list. And
I mean, do you think this time next year it'll still be on the list?
Yeah, I do, because I don't think that there, where there, if there, as we begin to see political, as and if we begin to see political will in the Obama administration to address Cuba policy more holistically, the terrorist list, I think, one will be of the more radioactive issues to address. I can't see the administration starting there. I think it ought to, but I think it will start on some of the softer issues.
Well, what do you think would happen if an American citizen today went to Cuba without appropriate authorization or went through Canada or Mexico? Would he or she be prosecuted is the question. Now, I know you don't work for the government, our government, but what would your advice be?
Well, you should ask your lawyer, but I would tell you that this administration seems to be enforcing the embargo more aggressively than the Bush administration on some fronts. It has
really
it in terms of not so much on the travel, but generally in terms of prosecuting third country private entities such as banks and other foreign investors under Helms-Burton inside of Cuba, and has many more people working to enforce the Cuba embargo than it does to enforce sanctions on other countries and generally sort of terrorist financing issues. I would say that until the Obama administration really develops its own policy towards Cuba, I would not advise against third countries sneaking in and out because it's too much of a risk. Follow the law.
I've decided to pick out two questions that will put you directly on the spot.
More so than I have been?
Oh, I think you've gotten off easily tonight, Julia.
Okay.
From Wally in the audience, Julia, do you agree with the UN General Assembly vote this year that the U.S. should end the embargo of Cuba?
Oh, I haven't been clear about that yet.
I just want to, I want it on the record.
Yes, I agree with the all but three members of the UN General Assembly who voted for the 18th year in a row that the United States should end the embargo against Cuba.
Good. Now, Roberto from UC Berkeley would like to know what you think of the author Brian Littell and his book After Fidel. Are you familiar with this book? Excellent. What do you think?
You know, I'm here to talk about my book.
Well, I wanted to say that. You know, and indeed, if you don't want to talk about the book that will be available for signing after this session, we could talk about the previous book, which is also very interesting. But do you have just two words on this?
Brian Littell's, I don't think he's ever been to Cuba. He may have been there once. He worked for the CIA for many decades as an analyst of Latin America and Cuba. And he has devoted a considerable amount of time to reading and analyzing the speeches and statements of Fidel Castro and of his brother Raul Castro. And on that basis, and he has become an avid Raul watcher and student. And on that basis, I recommend that you read his book.
But not tonight. Well, I have to say that what's interesting, there are many interesting things about analyzing these questions as they're handed to me, and that is the recurring concern about, first of all, why we still have this embargo, and secondly, what, if any, real economic openings will there be over the next, 5 years, right. I'd say. I mean, since you've put it in the 50-year scope of history. And one of the questions relates specifically to China and Vietnam as models of really very, models of government that have moved towards economic opening while not themselves moving actively towards democracy. And to what extent do you think even looking at those models has any effect on the Cuban government? Do you think they see any lessons there?
These are all excellent questions. Starting in the 1990s, very quickly after the wall fell and the Soviet subsidy was ended, the Cuban government did deploy its academics and its researchers from the university, from the military, from the party to go out and study other models. Including Europe, including the social democracies in Europe, but also Vietnam, China. And, you know, this is a country that I think will wind up in some sort of hybrid where it takes different experiences from different countries but makes those experiences its own. And so China, for example, which is so large and so far away from the United States, can't really be a model, and yet, you know, the opening of the economy and the retention of political control is certainly what I would expect to see out of the Raul Castro regime. Vietnam, likewise, same thing, smaller scale, but still a country of 40 million people instead of 11 million, so not a perfect model. But there is real thinking and communication, importantly, thinking about and communication with these nations over sort of how do you run an accounting system, what kind of training do we need. You know, the militaries, of course, both in Vietnam and China, are very important economic power brokers, and that is the case in Cuba as well. So there is a learning process that is underway.
Well, a quick subsidiary question. What do you see the role of the military evolving into under Raul in the next 5 years?
Well, you know, that is his political base.
Right.
He created the military institutions, then ran them for decades. And since the Cuban troops came home from Africa in the late 1980s, he has been instrumental in giving the military something to do while reducing their budgets and their numbers substantially, but directing the senior military officers as they retire into business. And so the three or four major enterprises that the military runs are also that are involved in tourism and involved in all kinds of investments both within Cuba and abroad are lucrative, and it's a way of maintaining the buy-in and mitigating against corruption that also is an ever-present problem that they work against. So I anticipate the military to remain an incredibly important and powerful institution in that country. And internally within Cuba, there's some pushback against this because there's a consciousness that there's an old saying, and I'm gonna goof it up, so I won't try to repeat it. But that the civilian control is enormously important, even in the sort of world of the Verde Olivo, that consciousness of civilian control remains a critical part of Cuba's national identity.
Well, thank you, Julia. That concludes our program for this evening. I am Mathea Falco, and on behalf of the Council on Foreign Relations and the World Affairs Council, I would like to say on behalf of all of us in your audience that this has been an extraordinarily instructive and interesting discussion. Julia has agreed, as you know, to stay afterwards up here and to sign copies of her newest book. And I encourage all of you to take advantage of this opportunity. Thank you and good night.
Thank you. I've had a wonderful time.